soon after I came back and was in charge of interiors, first under...
Came back to Ford.
Came back to Ford Dearborn, Ford Design Center. Mm-hmm. I was with Leonard Stobar, who didn't spend much time there. In January, he retired, and I was made the manager of interior. I had seen all these problems, and during the time that I had been away, 9 years, nothing really had new had developed. Mm-hmm. The only two things of significance was that in interiors, they were now using what they called a billboard, which was a long platform, a wood platform, upon which they would build a back wall, and on that wall they would do the complete interior side of each model, which was a new development. The other was the use of Dynoc, which had come in some time before and which we had picked up over in Germany.
Can you digress for a moment and explain the Dynoc. What Dynoc is and how it
developed? Dynoc is what is the full name is decalcomania, which is a transfer. You get all sorts of things that you can transfer a little design or an insignia or something. You pass it through water and you peel off the back paper, and this has an adhesive on it, and you put it on to whatever you wish to apply it to, and squeegee out the or rub out the water, mm-hmm. and it stays.
Well, it's sort of a super decal.
It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just a decalcomania in a long in a sheet. Comes in two widths, I think maybe 42 and 54, something like this, widths. And it's a film with paper backing. You can paint the film any color you wish, any finish you wish. And however, the paint that you use has a plasticizer in. In other words, it doesn't get hard, mm-hmm. so it remains flexible. Mm-hmm. And you cut this to the length that you need. If you're going to cover the whole side of the car, why, you'll cut a piece that's 16 feet long or whatever, mm-hmm. and you run it through a pan of water, and this separates the film from the paper backing, and you take off the film, and you'll have several hands doing this, of course, mm-hmm. and you'll bring it up to the model, and you'll take a sponge and throw some water, wet sponges, throw some water on the clay, which has been pre-finished and slicked, so there's a very good surface. And you lay the Dynoc film onto the model, and you take your sponge to begin with and work it, the Dynoc, onto the surface, and then you take what is known as a slick, which is really a plastic that has been very highly polished, and you use the edge of this plastic as a edge to really to press down and wipe out any water that might be underneath. The water is really a vehicle to be able to put the decal into its place. It sort of rides over the water, mm-hmm. and then you squeegee out, I guess you could call the slick a squeegee, mm-hmm. you squeegee out the water, and of course it's very pliable, so you can use the slick or proper shaped slicks to make the film take the shape of a wheel lip or pillars or depressions, whatever.
That's nice.
So it adheres to the clay quite well, and you trim it. And the bright metal parts that may be on a clay model, which are usually moldings, not necessarily moldings, but some of them are moldings, you do not put the Dynoc onto those. You leave those clay, and you use aluminum foil on those areas and slick those out.
So it's an attempt to make the clay model as realistic as possible.
Yeah, so you end up with a representation of a vehicle with bright metal, bright, and the other areas, painted areas, the color that you so wish.
Decalcomania.
Yes. How do you spell it?
Can you spell it?
I would have to look that one up.
D-E-C-A-L-C-O-M-I-N-A? No, I... M-N-I-A. Comini? Yeah.
It's made by 3M.
Is it? Okay, well, we could probably find something.
Yeah,
whence comes the nickname?
Well, it's just short. Decal.
Dynoc.
The Dynoc.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I won't say. I'm not sure.
Do you think it's sort of what we call in literature a folk or something which is really slang coming out of the
it could be
the sound of the name.
It's possible. It's possible that it had been sold under this name rather than Decal.
Ah, I see. As a catchy sales device.
Yes.
Possibly.
It seems to me that somebody else had developed this. It's made by 3M now, and only 3M makes it. And 3M only makes it at certain times of the year, and their rolls may be of any particular length. And they're not happy about making it, but they make it to satisfy the requirements of the industry. They make it because they sell the industry the wood grain transfer,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has a sticky back,
mm-hmm.
And they're more or less forced into making Dynoc for the design studios as a way of continuing the sale of their other materials.
Uh-huh.
At least this is what I've been told.
Oh, fascinating. Well, please proceed.
Well, anyway, other than those two things, why in the 9 or by that time almost 10 years that had elapsed, nothing of any great importance had evolved, except one more thing. They were doing everything, all model developments, full scale. When I had left, they were still doing 3/8 models in advanced model development.
Uh-huh.
But the one thing that Bordenay brought in was full scale models, because no one can really read a small model.
Mm-hmm.
And even a designer has a hard time evaluating a design in quarter or 3/8 scale.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was being done full size.
Did you applaud this?
Well, I think it's a proper way of doing the work. You can utilize scale models in early developments, but it's not something that you want to show management.
Mm-hmm.
We use 3/8 models in Germany to develop the initial P3, the first all new model.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, we did everything full scale.
Mm-hmm.
You can get fooled by some parts of a scale model, mm-hmm. and you get up to full size. Why? You find you look at it at a different angle and different proportion, and you just don't see them like you do in small scale.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, this required a much larger modeling staff. So the modeling staff had increased greatly during the period of time that I had been gone.
Mm-hmm.
And in interiors, of course, they had by that time set up individual studio areas for each car line, and there were a good many car lines. So there were something like, maybe I shouldn't even try to guess. Maybe 10 different car lines represented in interiors.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no organization other than the manager, and there were master modelers. So master modelers were in charge of these various car lines. And this was true both in interior and exterior.
Mm-hmm.
There were, at that time, I believe, four exterior, 3 or 4 exterior, I guess they called them design offices at that time, and each one had a clay modeling manager, and under him were master modelers in charge of various particular studios. Mm-hmm. Well, in interiors, the thing that was shocking to me was in the developments. These modelers would, and designers would complete a design, and they would be templated. This is the way that at that time they were getting the information to draft, because everything was released by draft, not by model. And so cardboard templates would be quite exact. Cardboard templates would be made from sections of the various models, and drafts of those working from the cardboard templates would be made. The difficulties being that what they were working with at the time, for instance, instrument panels, the instrument panel bucks were made from a wood structure which had a wood base and floor, which amounted to a floor. Mm-hmm. And it had some side structure, and it had three bulkhead, plywood bulkheads going through, one of them representing the firewall, but then in addition there would be at least one or generally two more bulkheads that ran all the way across. To build up the instrument panel, I guess one of these is this one that stands in front of the firewall. Mm-hmm. So there'd be one in front of the firewall and one behind the firewall. These would be drilled with 1-inch holes all the way through, and then 1-inch wood dowels would be driven through these holes and stick out in the area where the instrument panel would be, and on these plywood these wood dowels, clay would be laid up, and that's how you'd make the clay instrument panel.
Mm-hmm.
This was
rather cumbersome.
Well, it was a system that worked, let's say.
Okay.
And they had been using that system for a good many years, you know, like, I don't know, 20 years, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I think they were using that system when I first started out in 41, so nothing really had changed from the very early beginnings in design for instrument panel development.
At least at Ford.
At Ford.
Would you say that was due to the somewhat stolid and unimaginative leadership of the Stobart brothers?
No. It was due to the fact, you know, I went in really as a designer. I had, my interest was in design, but my abilities were, and interest also laid in the technical side of model development. Generally, modelers came from perhaps wood model making trade or plaster trade. They did not understand automobile design, and designers had gone through art school, which I didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no interest in the technical end of it, and no knowledge of the technical end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't care how you built the model, as long as they got it on a certain date. And they cared very little about the problems the modeler had. Management did very much to develop the designers, did very little to develop the modelers, and as a result,
it was really sort of a benign neglect.
It was a neglect that shouldn't have been.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a wide open opportunity for me, for anybody, as far as that's concerned.
With a little imagination, a little different.
Sure. Background. Well, I had done these various developments in Germany, and we had systems going over there that was way advanced of anything that existed here.
Mm-hmm.
So shortly after. Well, the problem that I saw,
yes,
before I was made model manager of interiors, they had sold their program, whatever year it was. This was in the fall of 67. And so the designs had to be drafted. So they had made templates and they had made drafts. Surface layout group had. And then the modeling group then had to do what they called at that time prove out. Mm-hmm. And this was a prove out of the draft. Because when you go from a clay model to a draft, many times much is lost as far as the design is concerned. Mm-hmm. So management, design management wants to make sure that the design, the intent of the design is still there. So these wood platforms or wood interior instrument panel bucks had a wood platform that would attach to them. They would screw down onto the wood base in a manner like this, so that they had a platform, a level platform with a straight edge, a wood straight edge, from which they could set up angles or height gauges or whatever else and work on this instrument panel.
Looks like an organ console,
doesn't it? It looks a little bit like an organ console.
All the stops.
Well, this whole thing was mounted on casters so that they could move it into the showroom or move it about the studio as necessary or into storage as might be. And so instrument panels were built up onto that, and they would do a very fine job in developing the instrument panel. But the difficulty was that there was no exact dimensional control of the clay model. Mm. I've seen, at that time, I've seen a surface layout man with his handful of templates come down, and they would put the wood platform back in the buck, and he would try to set up these templates to check them out, because he's got a whole handful of templates and he wants to know where they go and just how they fit and the comparison of one to another and so forth.
This is before the clay buildup.
Well, when it's all finished.
Oh, it's finished. Oh,
it's
okay.
Finished, yeah, right. Except that you haven't done the prove out yet.
Okay.
And I've seen situations where the engineer was able to get only within maybe 3/4 of an inch, mm-hmm. 3/8 of an inch, 1/4 of an inch, mm-hmm. of where the template says it should be. Mm-hmm. Well, where does it really go, you know? He really doesn't know. So all he ends up with is really a group of templates, and he's got to use these because he can't go back and check it into the model. It just doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. Well, the reverse situation would occur when the modelers then would get a drawing and they would have templates made from the fabrication shop, a whole series of templates, mm-hmm. and these would be used to develop a new model of the prove out of that drawing. So he's working from this wood platform into this wood buck, mm-hmm. and this buck may be moved from here to there from time to time, and as it is, and as he works on it, he goes back and tries to check something, or they decide to change a corner, his template no longer fits by 1/4 inch or 3/8 of an inch. It just doesn't fit.
I have to keep asking you this for my own benefit. The template is, function does the template have again?
The template is a section of a drawing, in this case, mm-hmm. made very exactly to that section of the drawing, mm-hmm. with reference lines and probably a base. The base of the template would probably be this work platform. Mm-hmm. Either that, or you have two reference lines, a horizontal and vertical. You set up the angle and use a height gauge to set the horizontal line and the edge of the angle and set the vertical line.
So they're precise reference points.
They're precise reference sections.
Sections, actually.
A complete line, mm-hmm. or yeah. section of whatever you're working on. Mm-hmm. So I came up with a design. I wanted to show you. I didn't find it yet. Maybe I'll find it. What?
If you could describe it verbally.
Well, basically, I did the step beyond the initial study that I had done in Germany. It was one that I had been planning to do in Germany, but had left in the meantime. on a steel surface table, we would develop a steel fixture which would be very exactly machined, so that we'd have exact surfaces to work from in this fixture, an exact surface to develop from on the table. And there would be locators in the fixture and locators on an armature. In other words, a socket and a pin. The pins would be on the armature and the instrument panel. The sockets would be on the fixture. The fixture would be machined very accurately with very accurate holes bored and tapped to accept the sockets. And the instrument panel would be a structure that would, a steel frame that would have enlarged holes that the pins would attach to, and they would be made with a thread and a nut. So you'd take the armature and set this onto the fixture, and once you've done this, and then lock up the nuts on the pins, then the fixture has accurately positioned the armature. The armature, even though before you locked it up, was not accurate, but once you've had these locating pins in the sockets on the fixture, and then lock up the nuts, why, it was quite exact. So anyway, I made a sketch freehand to show how this development could be done, and wrote a paper to demonstrate why this should be done, and I can't recall the process. How I know, however, that this was ran through our finance office, and we had determined, or they determined rather, the advantage from a point of view of timing and costs, and they found that it would have great advantages in cost. One of the difficulties with making these wood bucks was that there was one made for every model that was done, and then they were thrown away, and they were quite expensive. So that with the system that was being suggested is a system that you would use over and over and over, and nothing would be thrown out. And so
this is your innovation.
Yeah, so that the cost for building this very exact and sophisticated way of making models and modular way of making models would have a tremendous effect on cost and timing. So we made, and I took a man that was in interiors, and who had had engineering background and was a draftsman, and utilized his talents and ability to do this development. And once we had developed the first one, why, we had other things that had to be done. We went further into this, and so I took a second man, and then a third man, and eventually this built up into a modeling systems group that had about 10 people in it. So we were doing all of the development for all of Design Center. And these functions previously had been done by the engineering function in Design Center. But here again, the engineers didn't know anything about modeling and cared less. And as a result, their developments were, with these wood bases and so forth, were just not adequate for what we were getting into. We were reaching the point where they were going to scan, and they had very little information, correct information to go by to scan from, since the model, since you could not really say where that model was in space, and you have to have this information in order to scan. So anyway, I'd like to read a paper or part of it here which explains a little further the problems in the interior. And this is dated 3/25/71, so by that point in time we had gone through much of the development. And I have another one here that probably would read also. But anyway, let's see if we can go through this. I haven't read this for years, but let's see what it sounds like. The vast need for improved modeling equipment and methods in the interior studio was called to the attention of Design Center management in the fall of 1967. To cite an example of this need, the inability to maintain interior prove-out timing and accuracy caused additional delays to programs that were already behind schedule. Instrument panel prove-outs at that time were made in the same half bucks that were also used for the so-called picture models. The bucks for these models were constructed of wood and consisted of a portion of a floor surface, the firewall, A-pillars and cowl, plus a bulkhead structure that supported wood dowels upon which the clay was applied. To obtain a working surface for measuring and setting of templates, a separate work platform was bolted or screwed into place on the floor surface. This whole assembly was far too unstable for prove-out work. Movement of the panel surface was noted not only in relation to itself, but also in relation to the floor surface and to the platform work surface. A further complication of this difficulty resulted when the platform was removed after measuring or setting templates to permit adequate space for working on the model. Each time the work surface was again reinstalled for measuring, the location of the platform to the panel had changed. Due to these conditions, much rechecking and rework was necessary, which resulted in considerable confusion and lost time, since it was never possible to complete an instrument panel prove-out with an accurate, on-schedule model. It seemed obvious that other modeling methods could improve modeling efficiency. In order to accomplish this, on prove-out instrument panel models, an instrument panel armature system was recommended. This consisted of a stable modeling armature which would be mounted to a strong fixture that in turn would be attached firmly and accurately to a surface table. This would eliminate any movement of armature, mounting fixture, or work surface. This stable condition would permit accurate work to be accomplished in setting up templates or taking measurements. Confusion and lost time due to unstable and inaccurate conditions could be eliminated. Furthermore, instrument panel modeling armatures could be mounted in a buck as well as on a table, and the same units could be utilized for both picture models and prove-out models. They could be built in a way that would permit the transfer of a model from buck to buck, from buck to table or reverse, or to storage. Armatures and mounting devices so constructed would permit flexibility during instrument panel development that did not even exist. A go-ahead for the development of an instrument panel armature system for prove-out modeling was given at that time. This was the first development undertaken by the modeling systems activity. Following the development of appropriate drawings and the approval of a cost savings project appropriation request, the first new system was adapted for the prove-out of the four new 1970 program instrument panels. This armature system provided the means to reduce actual fabrication cost, permitted flexibility of instrument panel modeling, allowed instrument panel designs to be displayed in a more complete and natural environment, improve prove-out accuracy, and shorten the overall time to accomplish these tasks. The instrument panel armature system proved extremely valuable in prove-out modeling and was thus extended to both production and advanced development of instrument panels. To provide the accuracy to accomplish this required the procurement of 19 additional tables and 15 table fixtures. Thus, early in 1969, another cost savings project appropriation request was recommended and approved, which indicated a return on investment after taxes of 37.4% and which would result in a payout period of 3.9 years. To complete this armature system, attention was then focused on the difficulties involved in making fiberglass molds and casts of instrument panels and the time-consuming process of aligning and mounting these casts in bucks. Subsequently, a system was devised to mount the completed clay instrument panel armature into a tilting fixture for ease of mold construction, and in addition, through the use of a magnesium armature positioning jig to automatically align an armature mounting unit into an instrument panel cast. This fabrication system alone advanced to a considerable degree the art of fabricating and mounting instrument panel models. In the summer of 1968, a request was made by Design Center Management to replace the conventional trim bucks, the so-called black boxes, with modular units that would result in the display of interior design proposals at a much higher level of appearance. Since the use of the instrument panel armatures also provided for the upgrading of interior bucks, a study was launched to develop modular units that would permit not only a high level of display, but also the stability and accuracy of clay model construction that was being requested by design engineering. This study required the development of many 1/4 scale models, which were used for simulation and discussion with designers, engineers, and modelers. Construction techniques were reviewed with shop personnel and vendors. Finally, a sturdy all-aluminum half-buck prototype was built in the late summer of 1969. Following a complete evaluation of the prototype, all new drawings were constructed by the modeling systems activity to reduce construction costs and to improve the design and usefulness of the half-buck. An initial procurement for 12 of these all-new bucks followed the approval of a cost savings project appropriation request. The cost analysis for this project indicated that an estimated annual savings after taxes would result in a return of 86% with a payout period of 1.4 years. After the instrument panel half bucks were ordered, the modeling systems activity turned to the development of other portions of the modular units necessary to upgrade the trim bucks, i.e. roll-ups for seats, B-pillar structures for four-door roll-ups, package tray bucks, two-door, four-door, and quarter panel armatures, hinges, and many other detailed parts. Properties of these various units have all been procured, and this system has been expanded to encompass all interior programs begun during the past year. Models are now presented in a high presentation level and are shown in a more natural environment. All of these bucks and some of the armatures can be switched from one car line or program to certain others, and likewise they can be used for two-door, four-door, and coupe body types. With these improved modeling systems in use, it then became possible to concentrate on other aspects of interior model making, i.e. billboards, seats, consoles, and other detail models. To improve the quality of these types of models required, first of all, improved modeling bases. These models have always been built on specially constructed wood model bases, which generally were good only for one particular model or program. These bases were not stable, and they did not provide accuracy. However, with the development of a numerical control system, it has become necessary to build stable models that could be dimensionally controlled. A study concerning this situation resulted in the recommendation and approval of a cost savings project appropriation request for 23 various size steel tables. This project cost analysis, which was predicated on the conservation on the conservative low year usage experience, indicated a long-term return on investment of 28.7% and a payout period of 4.8 years. This study required the development of many drawings and the review of these drawings and plans with various concerned design center personnel, consultants from the numerical equipment development department, purchasing and vendors. This table project has been completed, and although the tables are being utilized, their ultimate use in the construction of high-quality models for NC scanning requires considerably more work. Billboard structures must be developed that will accurately position existing door and quarter panel armatures. In addition, armatures must be devised for seat models and for other interior models. An investigation into the design and construction of billboards is proceeding, and several variations are in use that have been developed by the interior modeling section. The fundamental advancements that have been related in this memo that either presently exist or are planned are, of course, germane to the task of providing the level of quality necessary for the direct post-processing and release of NC scan data. However, equally important is accomplishing this task is the procurement of highly accurate measuring equipment for interior modeling. Although these modeling systems are at the present time transitory and not fully developed, important advantages to the Design Center have already been achieved. Yet to be realized are greater corporate advantages that will result from the construction of stable feasibility models and the ability to maintain accurate dimensional control of these models.
Where was that presented?
Well, that was a paper I had written back in 325-71. These are the scale models of the bucks that were finally built.
And these are quite advanced from the ones you, from the ones you described
yes.
a few moments ago.
Yes. Also have...
How would you describe these in terms of... These are the modular...
Let's go to the actual ones here. The instrument panel, for instance, I described how the armature would be positioned to a fixture and the frame locked up. Well, on that frame would be mounted an impreg plywood or impreg base. eventually, they had used impreg. Impreg is sheets of mahogany that has been impregnated with a plastic material and compressed, and it's used for milling master models, hard models that are used for die model work, and it's very stable, will not move, and therefore you can use it for many things. Well, we used boards that were, I think, an inch or an inch and an eighth thick, and they were mounted to this frame that I had shown you, and that in turn was positioned onto the fixture, and it was then filled out with polyurethane foam that was bonded to the board, and then the clay was built up on the polyurethane foam. The polyurethane foam is very stable, will not move. So you end up with, in this case, an instrument panel model that can be made very accurately because you're working from a steel surface table and a platform at the back in either templates or points or whatever. You can develop this and work back and forth with it with whatever information is necessary, and it always stays the same and never changes.
This must have been quite a breakthrough for
it was.
From previous technique.
It was. And then a system was devised also, and although you can't perhaps see the whole system, this, what you see back here, is a hydraulic lift truck, which is moved by hand, but you'd bring that up underneath the instrument panel, and the instrument panel had tubes that were welded into this framework of the armature, and the forklift, hydraulic forklift little truck, had pins, and a device where you could lift the arms and the pins would lower, you bring it in under the instrument panel, and then you bring it down, and it would pick up the instrument panel in these tubes. And you would lift this, and you have to tip the instrument panel out. Of course, it was made to tip. And so the instrument panel would tip out from the lower points, and then you'd lift it off the upper points, and you could wheel the instrument panel away, and you would wheel it up to the instrument panel buck, which is this portion of these three units. And it would have the same locating points. So you'd wheel it up there and drop it in position and lower your hydraulic forklift truck and back away. And you had the instrument panel in a very stable and accurate instrument panel, what they called half buck. That unit replaced the wood unit, which we discussed earlier. Now this had the ability to move the fixture in that buck into different positions to take care of different requirements in various car lines. And this was also used to attach hinges, proper hinges, so you could obtain the proper hinge line. You would build in a floor, a wood floor, into this buck. You would build in armatures, at least, for the kick plate and the door sill. You would mount armatures for attaching doors. You could model the door surface in there, or cover it with actual materials, or hang on an actual door inner panel. And then you would, on the same units, you could cast portions of the exterior model that this would represent. And so you could have door outers and door inners. You could have the complete front of a car, or a portion of it, with the windshield, and you could have the back portion, and you would have these three groups. You would have the front portion, the ISMA panel, with windshield and front hood and door, and you would have the seat roll up for the front seat, and you would have the rear portion, would have the rear seat and package tray and so forth. They would all have exterior skin and interior pointments. And you could roll these together, and they would pin together and lock. They all would all have leveling feet, so you could level it out, and you could have the appearance of a completed vehicle, both interior and exterior.
Incredible.
And it was accurate.
And what?
And it was quite accurate.
That's fascinating. Quite a leap forward, looks like.
Yes. However, it was necessary in order to bring the model to a level of completion or finish that would permit the practical use of scanning. And until this was done, the efforts in scanning would not really be fruitful, because you wouldn't be able to provide the ability to say that this is what dimensionally it is supposed to be. Until you can provide that ability, well, you really don't have a complete system.
Well, were your superiors pleased with that?
Well, yes. As I mentioned here, there were several of these earlier programs that we ran through a cost study. And they found that each one of these save money and time. And therefore, after a while, they would incorporate these without a study, because it was sort of obvious that this was the result. The intent, initially, my intent was to provide better equipment to be able to have models that were accurate, that would provide accurate data when scanned. Of course, management objectives was to save money. My boss was Tom Burns, the director of administration in Ford Design Center, and he also had the controller under him in the finance department. So it was natural that he would run it through his finance department. In the fall of 1968, maybe September of 1968, I was called into Bordenay's office, and it was announced that I was going to be put in charge of all of modeling, not just interiors. So they created a new position, manager of I guess at that time they did call it clay modeling. And the other managers were put under me as section supervisors. Well, prior to that, I had been talking with personnel, and I had given them an organizational chart of the organization I had in Germany, where I had supervisors over modeling. And under the supervisors, we did have our master modelers. And so I had recommended that because of the very difficult structure of organization at that time in interiors, and this was the same in all of the other areas, There were really several studios, but nobody was really responsible except the manager, because you couldn't give those personnel responsibilities and other responsibilities to a master modeler. It wasn't a part of his responsibilities or capability. So this was picked up by personnel and worked on, and they decided that they would set up an organization with a manager of all of modeling, which I was promoted to, and the
current modeling services.
Well, modeling services became a part of it. Mm-hmm. It was a separate group with a supervisor.
Yeah.
Under this were the, I guess at that time, then four section supervisors. And under the section supervisors, we had to promote supervisors. So after some discussion, considerable discussion, we promoted, I believe at that time, 12 master modelers into section supervisor. And so that we had a functioning organization, at least from the point of view of an organizational chart. So we had a supervisor in each studio area, and or perhaps one supervisor covering maybe a couple of studios, depending upon the situation. And master modelers would be responsible for what they were supposed to be responsible for, which would be development of a particular model. And this, one of the first things that happened was that the same situation that existed in interiors, in lack of ability to develop accurate models, existed in exterior. And so I started right away to expand modeling systems and set it up as a separate entity with a supervisor to do the exterior models also. So I'll read that paper.
If I could interpolate here a question. Charlie Stobart told me that at one time in his career, modeling and fabrication was separated. How did fabrication fit into this setup?
Well, at that time, Stobart was still there, of course, and Stobart had fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at that particular time, modeling, before they centralized modeling, modeling came under the each individual design office.
Right, you've mentioned that. Yes.
So that there was no central organization. One of the advantages of centralizing this was supplies, because at that time each design office was buying their own clay, and had their own storage areas and other materials. The Dynoc and the aluminum foil and all the other materials. Each office, each manager had his own area where he had this stashed. So one of the first things that happened, and this is one of the things that Tom Burns was interested in,
mm-hmm.
was centralizing all of these, the purchase and storage of all these materials.
Right. Must have been a nightmare for him.
Well, it had been, yeah. And so this proved to be of considerable aid to mm-hmm. him at that time. One of the other advantages at that, during this same period of time, was the clay itself. They had been buying clay from Milton Bradley. They, before that time,
the game manufacturer.
Yes, Chavant initially had mm-hmm. had manufactured the clay, and then Milton Bradley was buying children's clay from Chavant,
mm-hmm.
and I am told, and under good authority, that Milton Bradley would come in, Chavant, and look around and see what they were doing, and they took the formula, and they went back to Boston, wherever they were from. It was up in New England, I think it was Boston area,
mm-hmm.
and started manufacturing the styling clay.
They had stolen the formula.
They had stolen the formula.
Mm-hmm.
And
without permission, obviously.
Without permission, and they bit into Chavant's sale of styling clay.
Was there any way Chavant could have
well,
sued?
What happened, this was being run by the wife of the original owner. The owner had died, his wife was running this business. And,
in France, of course.
No, it was in New Jersey.
Oh, that's right, they'd established a, yes, an American outpost.
Right, it? And so this was purchased by Paul O'Neill in the early 1960s, perhaps in 63, I'm not sure, something like
O'Neill,
this.
Did you say?
Paul O'Neill, O, capital N, E-I-L. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing he did, the next time Milton Bradley came down and wanted in, he threw them out, and he says, I'm not going to sell you any more children's clay either. So he says, you've had your last shipment. Mm-hmm. And so he cut them off and came in, and he wanted to develop a new clay. Mm-hmm. So we went through a period of, I don't know, a couple of years anyway, mm-hmm, working on with various samples, and came up with a new formulation, of which, of course, Milton Bradley wouldn't know about. Mm-hmm. And it had several advantages, one being it had better adhesion to itself, which was one of the problems. So it had less tendency to crack. And it had good tack, good workability.
Tack?
Yeah, to attach to whatever you want to attach it to.
Oh, I see. Adhesion.
Yeah, adhesion to an armature. Mm-hmm. Adhesion to itself. And of course, from time to time, they do have problems still, occasionally from time to time. But in any case, it was a superior clay, and it was a new formulation, and nobody has this except Chavant. Chavant, by this point in time, sells virtually the world automobile industry.
You mean in 86?
Yes.
But back in 68, he had pretty much the market then, didn't he?
Well, he got Ford. Of course, they had GM. GM had never left them. Mm-hmm. Eventually, he licensed a company in England. Uh-huh. And with the idea of selling Ford of England, which, of course, they did. But by now, of course, they sell to all of Europe.
Okay.
And he had been selling clay into Japan, so he has a licensed company there that is making the clay and selling it to the Japanese industry. So at least 95% of the clay used in the world in the automotive industry and related vehicle industry is used, is clay from Chavant.
What happened to Milton Bradley? Did they graciously bow out?
I think they're completely out of it.
Yes.
I think they may still be in the children's clay, but which is really a plastiline.
Is it?
But
not a true clay.
It's not a styling clay, yeah, which is a hard clay. I think they're completely out of the styling clay. 3M tried to get into this with a clay that, instead of sulfur, had a glass bead.
Hmm.
And a very small glass bead. And one of the advantages of this was lightweight. So we went through a development of this with 3M, Milton Bradley, and Chavant. They all came up with a glass bead clay. The advantage, of course, would be that it would take some of the weight off of the clay buck,
mm-hmm,
and particularly in moving, which would have some advantage. And
had that been a problem previously that might cause internal destruction?
Well, I'm going to get into the exterior model.
Okay, good.
It would have, or it did, before we came up with the new frames, but after we came up with the new frames, it really didn't make that much difference.
Okay.
So we went through a development. We got a shipment of the de-aired, of the glass bead clay, and we tried it, but Mahler's complained of the difficulty in finishing the clay. It took longer to finish because it was harder to work.
Mm-hmm.
And their tools tend to be dulled by the glass bead, which is interesting.
Uh-huh. So when you say glass bead, what specifically are you referring to?
Well, it's a very small, like a powder, but it's glass.
It is really glass.
And each one of these little cells are hollow. And I don't know how they make this, but therefore it's lighter than sulfur.
Mm-hmm.
And the clay was light enough to float on water, which you're not going to float the clay on water, but anyway, it did reduce the weight of the models by, I used to know, by 1/5, 1/4, something like this.
But the wear and tear on the designer tools...
Well, that and the fact that it was took longer to finish a model, yeah. And that was the really big drawback.
Mm-hmm.
So we never really went away from the revised clay. However, the revised clay had some interesting points besides those things that I mentioned. One of the problems that would occasionally arise would be the clay, they would put carbon black in the clay to give it a little bit darker color.
Mm-hmm.
And you put the clay in an oven, and this carbon black would tend to bleed. And if the clay was in the oven for a longer period of time and then mixed up with other clays on the model, you'd end up with a marbleized effect.
Oh.
So one of the things we did with the Ford clay was to eliminate the carbon black.
Mm-hmm.
So that the Ford clay now is a harder clay and does not have carbon black and does have, however, these other advantages. And so it is, I believe, the clay, the Steinen clay, that is most used of any of the clays. The GM clay is very similar, except it has more oil, so it's softer, and it does have the carbon black yet. This is a paper that entitled In Quest of a Goal, and I believe this was written, I'm not sure, I don't have a date on it, this is rather strange. Must have been written also in 40, or in 71 perhaps. When design modeling was centralized into a separate department under the Director of Administration and Planning, several advantages were anticipated. Among these advantages were improved first-line supervision, improved manpower balance and utilization, improved modeler timing, improved modeler training and development through rotational assignments, more equitable merit and promotional planning, better control and more equitable equalization of overtime, improved administrative management of modeling, better control of modeling equipment, reduced inventory of modeling supplies due to centralization, and greater progress in development of modeling equipment. All of these advantages have been realized. In addition, since highly sophisticated NC scanners were under construction for design center engineering that would possess the ability to scan and dimension models with extreme accuracy, it was anticipated that the centralized modeling function would provide the means to coordinate the use of this NC capability on those efforts affecting clay modeling. However, to take advantage of this capability would require stable modeling armatures. Since the value of information scanned from a clay model is directly related to the quality or accuracy of the clay model that is scanned, highly improved clay model quality was considered fundamental to develop this NC capability. While improved stability and dimensional control of models had been considered necessary, the extent of this technical need was underestimated and misunderstood, inasmuch as the means for research and development of modeling equipment had been greatly inadequate. Design of modeling armatures, bucks, work platforms, and other equipment prior to 1969 had been accomplished by the various studio resident engineers or was purchased from outside suppliers. Lack of knowledge of modeling work by the people engineering this equipment resulted in the construction of armatures and bucks that did not fulfill modeling requirements and thus created the situation where a satisfactory dimensional control of models was impossible. Prior to the use of NC scanning equipment, the accuracy of clay models was less important, and although the modeler on the job realized the shortcomings of the equipment with which he worked, there was little concern to improve it. With the advent of NC in the design center, improvement became essential. Centralization design modeling made possible the reevaluation and redesign of mounting equipment on a universal basis. Simple changes and improvements in armatures and bucks, however, would not correct the situation. Instead, all new systems and methods would have to be developed to fulfill this need. To accomplish this, the modeling systems unit was established, and designers were assigned to this unit who had drafting, engineering, and tooling experience, and who also had full and complete modeling experience. These designers understood the shortcomings of conventional equipment, and they had the technical background to create new systems. Under the guidance of the supervisor, modeling systems unit, and overall control and coordination by myself, all aspects of model making have been greatly changed and substantially improved. First of all, to fulfill this fundamental need for improved clay model quality, stable structures were designed as modular and adjustable units for both exterior and interior models. The modular and adjustable designs of these basic structure units permitted them to be used on various car lines and on various model programs from year to year. In addition to having stable structures upon which